Hey everybody, welcome back to the TCP. I am John Stamp, and with me at my feet is Tiger Dog, who is already asleep. Possibly he had a big night last night. I was sleeping, I couldn't tell you. Or he only got like four naps today on the couch and he needed to catch up. Either way, he's not into it. So we're just get started while he's hopefully he doesn't start snoring. First off, thank you for all the compliments on the new cover for Wraith. Jeff Hayes did a fantastic job capturing the tone of Wraith of Sheltermount in that one. Very dark and very intense. And I am really glad you guys like it so far. Feedback's been awesome. And second, continuing thanks for support for the books I've put on Audible this year. Brothers Keeper, Spoilers, and Blood Red Ivory. Doing really well, all thanks to you. And thank you very much for all the compliments and comments that you sent me. And lastly, a short little plug. Mentioned it before, but Blood Red Ivory, the Kindle version, is still on sale on Amazon. So just throwing it out there if you haven't gotten around to picking one of them up yet. And that's let's call that it for the admin portion of the show. Tonight, I get to talk to Steve Dittmars. Steve is the award-winning author of the Big Dog series. He is a retired police officer out of Long Beach, California. Steve held positions in patrol, police canine, IT, homeland security, counterterrorism, and police communications. And he is now on his second book in the Big Dog series. And Steve, very welcome. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure.
Absolutely. Yeah, the Big Dogs. I was surprised that I realized after I got through book one, it was a two book series. I was wondering how they came out so fast, but I guess book one had been marinating a while and book two came through. I haven't gotten to book two yet, but, book one was a lot of fun. It was, I'm character driven. I really liked, the team you kind of built, and all the different, components that they all bring to the table, especially, the idea of having a pair of dogs instead of a single dog, and the circumstances are great. So how did the Big Dogs come up?
Well, when I was at Long Beach PD, we actually had a bloodhound program. We had an officer involved shooting. One of our motor officers was shot and injured. He was hit in the head in his helmet and survived. Our command staff had just seen a demonstration by Orange County Sheriff's Department bloodhound team. So they called him out. They gave him the suspect had fled on foot from a stolen vehicle. And so he collected a scent pad using an overgrown dustbuster and gave it to that bloodhound. And that dog followed and ended up at a restaurant that was by that time closed. And what we learned later when we caught the suspect was that he had gone there, made a phone call, and a friend in Compton, which would be the next city north of Long Beach, he came down, picked him up. So the dog in that case was dead on and did a great job, but we didn't know it at the time. And that's kind of, you know, we started our program based on that. And we worked with Orange County and LA sheriffs and several other agencies that have dogs. And we took the program to, I won't say a different level, because all those guys are doing great stuff. But one of the things we were able to do was get involved with universities and start developing scientific studies that they could use for the FRI standards, so that get the bloodhound evidence accepted in court. So that was a big part of what we did when we first started off. But my handler, Billy Kift, he was involved in cases with the FBI, a serial murder case up in Alaska, and that he was actually involved in the DC sniper case, kind of out on the periphery. But, you know, we had a good program. It was successful. But as is the case with programs where people are paid to do a job, there wasn't enough work and couldn't justify keeping, the chief couldn't justify to the city council keeping an officer doing that full time. And this was right at when I retired, it was right when money got really, really tight, which was 2009 for us. But what the program did, I spent a lot of time as I put it in the book, you know, on the southbound end of a northbound dog, watching the dogs work, watching the handlers work, got to see a lot of great handlers and see how this technology, for, you know, lack of a better word, how it worked and what a great tool it could be. And from that, I started thinking about writing a fictional story. And I didn't want to write, you know, the true stuff. I don't want to contaminate any cases or anything. There are some minor touches in the books where I refer back to, they weren't even bloodhound cases. So we started doing that. We started working with the government, and actually at one point they had asked us, you know, can you teach us to do this, but with not with a bloodhound, but with a like a German Shepherd or, you know, a normal patrol type dog? And we worked it, and they could do it. They weren't as good. I mean, there's nothing in terms of scent work that's going to beat a bloodhound, but these dogs were good enough. And so we did that for a while. And out of all of that, as I was saying, came this idea for this team to, you know, chase bad guys, and worked in some of the actual stuff that we did in terms of things that worked, things that didn't work. Example, I spent some time, it's actually in the second book, talking about when do you say no? Because, you know, when we first started out, we didn't say no. We chased every car burglar and you name it, garage burglars, everybody, murderers, didn't matter. We chased everybody. They called us, we went. And that's part of selling the program. And so we did that. But eventually what I saw was I was wearing out my handler, and we were having to use other guys. And fortunately, we had a pretty good pool of people in Southern California that we could call on. But, you know, you want to use your own guy, but you can't wear him out either. So we had to set criteria for, you know, what it would be that we would, you know, call the guy out from home. If he was working, you know, it's just another part of the day for him.
So you funding something like that. So I'm guessing your bloodhounds were in supplement to the working dogs. Did Long Beach have a regular working dog program, and then the back bloodhounds then, were like an experiment?
Back then we had, I think, a dozen patrol dogs, two or three bloodhounds working with the team. And then we had probably three or four bomb dogs also. And some of those dogs are cross-trained. Obviously, the bloodhounds weren't. But some later when we started working with shepherds, we started actually using some of those dogs as bloodhound in addition to patrol dogs. But you have to be careful how you go about that, because you've got a patrol dog, which is a dog that's trained to bite, and you've got to be careful, you know, are you going to send him to go find a lost kid? Some of them you could, but others you couldn't. So you just got to, you know, it's common sense, managing your resources and picking the best dog for the job.
Yeah. And in the, in Big Dogs, you, well, there are the part where you took them through the evaluation. And I don't want to give a bunch. I don't want to give a bunch away. It's a great read. It's a very original take on the crime procedural, because I don't think I've seen that a canine focused team put together like that. I can't remember a novel that was like it, that I saw a canine in use. Of course, there's been canines in use in other books before, but not something that follows and educates the reader on. I mean, you talk about a lot of science in that book, but you know, getting into the psychology of what is your dog saying, and you know, who's the problem here? Is it your dog or is it your handler? I think there was a great quote that I wrote down: "Great dog, shitty handler." Is that a technical term in the canine world?
Good dog, shit handler. Yep, I actually learned that from a German instructor when I was at narcotics school, but it's true. You know, that you have to pay attention and trust your dog. And a lot of what we talk about in that first book is JW, who's the main character, JW North, relearning, because he used to be a dog handler, but this is a different kind of work. And he's got to learn to really trust the dog, because what you're working with, you can't see unless you get lucky. A lot of, you know, when we were really doing this for real, a lot of times we would get information that would help us later identify a suspect or contribute to the investigation. Very seldom when you run a trail do you actually get that positive feedback of finding the bad guy at the end. And that's something in writing a fictional book, I had to kind of give a little bit more of that, because I don't know that the readers would enjoy and continue to read a book that really just didn't give a lot of positive feedback and, yeah, you know, catching bad guys and such. So one of the things I'm a stickler for accuracy. And when I wrote the book about the selection, the section about the selection and the training, I wanted to put a lot in there, but I wanted to work it into the story and introducing different characters, but not make it into a training manual.
Yeah.
And I think I got that. It's a tough one because I've read a lot of books. You know, you mentioned about, you know, other books about working dogs, and I don't know of anybody that pays attention to the amount of time and you know, just a little secret to your listeners. There's a lot more. I mean, we used to spend hours and hours and hours, several days a week, working on putting together scenarios for the dog and introducing them to different things. And I definitely couldn't do all of that because people would be pulling their hair out. And they wouldn't read it, and I wouldn't blame them. You've got to have the action. You've got to have feedback. But I couldn't write it without at least addressing that and trying to make it seem real to the reader. I try to, you know, I have a beta reader team. It's probably got about almost 20 people in it nowadays because people keep volunteering, and probably half to two thirds are law enforcement in one capacity or another. Dog people, firearms people, forensics, I got a couple of medical people, some veterinary, and I got a retired FBI agent. I've worked with the FBI on a number of different projects over the years, but I didn't understand a lot of their technical stuff. And so a friend of mine had sent his book to a retired FBI agent, and the guy was interested in being a reader. So I talked to him, and it turned out, you know, you talk about small world and 6 degrees of separation, this guy had actually worked a serial killer case in Alaska with my handler.
Oh, that's...
They'd flown Billy up to Alaska to work this case. And I asked him, I said, hey, did you know Billy Kipp? And he says, well, I saw him, but I spent most of my time, I was working the boneyard. And he said, I had this woman, and she said, she had a cadaver dog. And she said, that dog wore us out running around, but finding body after body after body. So it was just, how weird was that? But he's been a big help to me in getting the FBI stuff right.
Yeah.
And it's most of it's little stuff, but as a reader, I find that's the stuff that drives readers crazy, or at least it does me. I read and I start seeing they get stuff wrong. Gun stuff, it really jumps out at me.
Cocking a Glock.
Yeah. Yeah. Flipping the safety on the Glock, and no, and I can only put up with a certain amount of that before I just put the book down and give up, because it's like, if he didn't do his research on that, or he or she, then what else did he miss? So it's that stuff's important to me, and that's why I have this beta reader group, and then the other third to half of them is they're people that have no law enforcement background. And their sole function is to read it, tell me if it's too much, or if they didn't understand something because of jargon, things like that. And so those two, the third book's actually going out to the beta team here real quick.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah.
That book I'm hoping to get out probably, you know, 4 months, I'm hoping. We'll see.
I like, I like
it always
the
seems to take longer.
Yeah, I know, right? Once it's in somebody else's hands, you're along for the ride.
but
I like the team of characters there, and the bad guy is just, he's got a depth too that I really enjoy. But before we get off of that research part, the way you mentioned, you brought up Fry, but then you also took us far enough through that evaluation phase to get enough to show that that context to what goes into that. So all of that builds, and I'll butcher it, and I have a feeling I'm probably going to get some comments on this one. But for those people who don't know, and correct me if you probably got more experience on this than I do, but when you're going to be an expert witness in a court, the material you're testifying on, you have to show the scientific basis for why we trust that particular piece of information, how we gather that information, and how it's based through scientific research and proven method for the jury to trust it. Is that a pretty good capsule?
You pretty much got it. Yeah.
You
know, I've had to testify as an expert in dog stuff before. And first you got to establish your credibility.
Yeah.
But then you have to go in on something like this that's not generally accepted in the scientific community. And that's one of the catchphrases in Fry. If it hasn't been in a number of, you know, in this case, double blind peer reviewed studies, then it's not generally accepted. And that really limits what you can talk about in court. And of course, you know, any defense attorney is going to try and attack that. That's what they get paid the big bucks for.
You
pretty much got it there. You don't want to talk to the jury about it. You're going to have to establish to the judge that you know what you're talking about, and that body of scientific information validates the use of it in you bringing it into court.
And so not only are you proving your expertise, but you wouldn't want to call the dog a tool, a law enforcement tool, but you're proving the dog's ability to identify in a repeated process, specific, whether he's a bomb dog or a narcotics dog, in this case, a trailing, a scent dog. Whereas we can train the narcotics or the bomb dog by putting out the packets and having them track them down. Explaining human scent, especially time, the time that has gone by and how long a dog can pick it up, getting into that depth of details, you guys had to kind of establish through cooperation with the university that scientific basis to get that into court.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, that continued after I retired. I don't know at what point we are now. I still talk to my old handler, but we haven't talked about Fry in a while.
Yeah, it's just, I don't get to talk about it much either, but you brought it up and it's an interesting topic because it's, you know, the number of olfactory scents, how sensitive the dog's nose is, what species the dog is, what's its test record, all that stuff goes in there. And it blended really well with that evaluation phase that you guys put the dog and JW through in that book. And it was very interesting. I'd never thought of it because all I ever saw was, you know, the canine guys would come run a sweep of a car for me, or they'd back us up on a search warrant. And then, you know, we'd be talking, I'd see him go on training day and they'd run out and plant something and dog has to find it. They keep records of it. So, but the idea of trailing somebody it's been a day or two since they've walked that trail and explaining the science that goes into that, the way you laid it out for us was educational, but not to the point of like, you know, when Tom Clancy will explain the bolts that go into a submarine level, we didn't get there, which was nice. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah. I've read a few Clancy's or you could go into Tolkien walking through the forest and telling you about every tree as he passed them and the knots. And there's a place for that level of detail, but I don't think it's in this fictional series. It would be just too tedious.
Yep. And I think, you know, on a techno thriller, they want that. When it comes to the crime thriller, you're on a clock. You got to keep that tempo up. And if you don't have something blowing up, somebody chasing somebody or fighting, it's you're running out of clock. You know,
I had a buddy of mine. He was a former dog handler and SWAT guy. And he says, you know, all this is nice, but I'm really here for the, you know, for the dog catching the bad guy stuff.
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, I get that, but you already understand it. You've been a dog guy, and I'm trying to get, this is something that, you know, you can't even go into court and just talk about because it's not generally accepted, or at least it wasn't then. Yeah. And so I'm trying to get buy-in from my readers to believe this, you know, to take that leap of faith. And the first book, Big Dogs, when I wrote it, I got a publishing deal early on, and COVID killed it. So my wife and I made a decision that we were going to self-publish. So we had the book. I sent it to a professional editor because I really believed it was important that that first book be typed. Oh, yeah. And I learned so much from her that it was just amazing to me how bad some of the stuff that I did was. And, it, you know, as much trouble as I went to, she would say, what is this? And what are you talking about? Because you might think everybody knows it, but I don't know it. And so if I don't know it, other people won't know it. And so it was funny when I first started working with Robin, the book was, I think, about 88,000 words. And she says, well, the norm for your genre is 80, you know, we'll trim that down. After she got through with, I need more here, it became a 93,000 word book. So, you know, she found she wanted more. And I figure, well, you know, she knows what she's doing. I certainly don't.
Yeah, she's the pro. That's,
yeah.
Yeah. And it's so,
she did a great job.
And it's so important to make sure that your editor is part coach and part slasher, right?
She spent more time probably teaching me than editing, and she did a great edit. I really liked it when that was a self-published. The original first edition of Big Dogs is self-published. And then a friend of mine said, well, when you do your second book, why don't you send it to these guys? They do a lot of true crime, but they're starting to get into, you know, crime fiction. Mm-hmm. And so I sent it to Wild Blue Press, and I sent the second book, and I mentioned the first book, and they said, well, you own the rights, correct? And I said, sure. And they said, okay, well, we want the first book, the second book, and we'd like to write a first refusal on the third and the fourth.
Nice.
And I said, oh, I guess they liked it.
Yeah, you got it.
Hey, yeah, and that's exciting. You know, for the listeners out there, you know, if you've never been an author, which I haven't, but I mean, that when you first send your first book out there and you're kind of laying yourself out to the world, and for a publishing company, now this is a, you know, small to medium sized publishing company, but still, you know, they want almost four books for me. That's exciting. That's a sit down and have a glass of tequila and celebrate for 5 minutes. And then guess what? You're going back to work because writing the book's the easy part.
Yep. Right after that tequila, it gets all a little intimidating.
Well, it's the edit and the re-edit. I mean, there's so many decisions you got to make. And I'm in a way, I'm really glad that I did self-publish the first book because I got a better understanding of the mechanics of that end. So that when I talk to the publisher, I can, you know, be somewhat, you know, knowledgeable. I had to go out and get my own ISBN number for the, you know, cataloging and stuff. But yep. It was a lot of work. You know, thank God for YouTube, because there's instructions for just about every phase on there. You just got to find an instructor that you can listen to.
Yeah, you can fix your car on YouTube, and you can format your book on YouTube all in the same 10 minutes. And a full disclaimer, most people know this, but I'm also a Wild Blue author. Same thing. It's just a professional outfit. Like when they took it on, I was very supportive. The media is good. The marketing's good. The their editing staff, like, yeah, they're not afraid to tell you how it feels.
Yeah, no, and they caught stuff. We went back through Tanya edited my first book, and the second time for the second edition at Wild Blue, and she caught something that was funny because it was right in the first book, but by the time we got to the second book, in this first book they end up in Las Vegas, mm-hmm. and in the original first edition, I identified that as McLaren Airport. Well, it's changed. It's Harry Reid Airport now.
Yeah.
And so I said, you know, that puts me in kind of a odd spot, because the book actually takes place during the time frame when it was McLaren, but people are reading it now for the first time. I said, so it became Las Vegas International Airport, which is another name it's referred to by, but it just seemed like the best way to solve it for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. It's stuff you don't even think about. Like, they would catch just the littlest things. I'd be like, how did I miss that? You know, for any author who's putting their first book together, if you think you can do it by yourself, you're not going to be happy with the results. You got to have somebody that will, you know, it's funny. You got to have the thick skin for all the rejection letters. And then you have to have thicker skin, because once they take it, they're going to beat your baby up.
Oh yeah.
You know,
yeah, it was rewarding yet painful.
Yeah.
But you know, having done it and having been through doing it both different ways, I really find that it's painful, yeah, but it's well worth it. You come out with such a better product at the end, a better read. And, you know, in addition for me of telling the story and, you know, writing something that readers will enjoy, it's producing something that, you know, I can be proud of. Now, I guarantee you there's probably still a mistake in there.
Oh yeah.
And they're on me. Yeah. You know, it's hard. I don't even try to edit my own stuff, because I know what it's supposed to say. I'll read right over missing words. Fortunately, they've got computer software to help you with that. But yeah, it amazes me how the brain will fill in the blanks for you.
Yeah, the pattern recognition software just covers it right up.
Yep.
Yep. Yeah, it was, what was I going to say? You mentioned something. I'm sure it'll come back to me as soon as we hang up. But
3 o'clock in the morning. That's
yeah, exactly. Comes. Exactly. I was wondering though, speaking of the crew, and this is just a tangent, it's probably not related to anything, but Bonnie's maiden name is Bonnie McLean. Was that a shout out? Was that a subtle diehard shout out you wanted to throw in there with a Bonnie Bedelia and a John McLean mashup?
Correct.
Oh, yes. Sweet. I love it when I find that. I'm like, oh yeah, there it is. There's a diehard shout out.
One of these days I'm going to be in front of a bunch of readers. I've done a number of presentations, but I'd really like to get in front of a bunch of readers and we can do big dog trivia and talk, because there's a whole bunch of Easter eggs hiding in the books.
Okay. Well, now I feel bad. I've caught one, but I missed like 10.
Well, and it just depends on whether you saw the same movies I did.
Yeah. Right.
But they're, and books too. There's several book references, but a lot of movie references in there. Just because it just seemed appropriate to me at the time. And you know, the first person I have to make happy is me.
That's right.
And, and if I'm happy, then that means that there's probably a small percentage of people in the world that think like me. And so they're good. And then my wife and the beta reader team tear through it. And then we make more people happy.
Yeah. I've started doing that. I started doing that, I think, book 4 or 5, like whatever, like I would have a soundtrack, whatever book I'm reading, I'll have a soundtrack for it. And it'd be some random 90s music. For one, I think it was, you know, Eve 6 and Foo Fighters. Like that was just my jam all the way through the book. So I'll try to slip in one of my guys wearing a Foo Fighters t-shirt or something to make some little reference to it. And I found with the second Ty Benhoff I'm writing now, he ended up wearing nothing but Rock Band t-shirts like the entire story. And I was like, that just isn't gonna work. So I was like, this is getting a little too obvious.
But you'd be in with John Sanford then with I can't think of that guy. That it's not his primary, it's just one of his secondary characters that's always wearing a rock band t-shirt.
Yeah.
You'd be in good company. He's very successful.
Oh yeah, he's good. Maybe I'll keep it because they're pretty good bands. So Wild Blue gets a hold of book two. Did you always have like a 3-4 book arc in mind? Or when they said we want write a first refusal on 3 and 4, were you like, well, I guess I gotta figure out what I'm gonna do with these guys for 3 and 4?
Well, we talked about this when we first started chatting, but we haven't talked about it with the audience. And you know, I'm what they call a pantser. Of course, the first time I heard that, I thought the guy was calling me a pervert or something. Yeah. But there, you know, there's in general terms, there's two styles, you know, pantsers and plotters. And the plotter's got his flow charts and his 3x5 cards and his pictures, and it's got it all laid out, and it follows a very formulaic method to the writing. I do the bulk of my writing in my head, and then I sit down and write it. So I think about it. I think in terms of scenes.
Yeah.
And I'll think about the characters and how they're interacting. I'll think about the dialogue. I'll think about what's going on in the background, all these different things, and how it moves the story and the plot forward. But I do it all in my head. So I can tell you, in general terms, the plot of the fourth book. But I wrote the first one. I wrote about half of it. My wife went away on vacation. That was her biggest mistake ever. She went away on vacation with her girlfriends, and when she came back, I had half a book. And she didn't know I was going to write any book. I had mentioned, yeah, I want to write a book someday. She thought I was going to write a training book.
Yeah.
And I got a story to tell. And yeah. I figured, okay, the first one came out in about 6 weeks, because I thought about it for so long. And I knew from that book, I knew where the second one would start. And, you know, you talk about character arcs. You know, there's different character arcs and different crimes occurring within the stories. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, I've never been a homicide detective, but I've worked a lot of homicides as a patrol guy in Long Beach, California, where I was a police officer. The patrol officers do a lot more at that beginning stage than a lot of departments do, depending. You know, if they've got a lot of resources, they'll roll up the scene, roll out the yellow tape, and they're done.
Yeah, that's it. Yep.
Whereas we'll go through and take everything right up to the crime and maybe whatever interviews they're going to do as a result of that. And you know, so you get a much better picture. And then, you know, if it's a big case, the detectives will be reaching back out to you, and they usually won't tell you what they are working, but they'll tell you how they got there later on.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting stuff. But what I got from all of that was, it's not like on TV. You have the murder in the first 5 minutes and solve it in the last 5 minutes of an hour cop show. It doesn't work like that in the real world. And so I decided that there were going to be different people that were going to span different arcs, as obviously a book covers only so much, you know, in a story. So there are multiple characters that are bad guys that span multiple books.
Yeah.
Without giving away too much more, because I don't want to, but the, you know, you're obviously your protagonists, your good guys, they're going to be in all the books, or, you know, for the most part. But the bad guys are, they come and they go.
Yep.
And so, you know, I said, you know, I'm not going to, that's not real. You know, one of my biggest critiques of TV is they paint this unreal picture of what the profession is like, of what guys are, you know, what they do for their jobs, you know, and everything from the crime lab to where they, you know, instant results on things to, you know, the patrol officer who doesn't do anything other than show up and stand there and do a lousy job of crowd control so that some witnesses can run into the crime, you know, into the crime scene and grab the lead detective.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's funny on, and my side of the country, I don't know how it is now. This is 20 years ago, but that was, our patrol. When we were on patrol, we were pretty much find it, wrap it up, maybe talk to people and get a feel for it. But they had roving crime scene units. So we didn't get to do any, the patrolman didn't touch, not even like a B&E, like that we'd have to call it a roving crime scene unit to dust a car. We'd pretty much just get a handle on the scene and have the detectives come in. So it's interesting. And other, if you've got the resources, yeah, you can, it'd be nice to kind of try to get a little closure. Cause like you say, you know, once the detectives get there or the next level gets there, you're kicked back 08 and no idea what happened. Yeah. How'd that resolve? You know, if it's not a domestic or somebody going to jail, they're just like, all right, well, thanks for your time. Read about in the papers.
3 years later, you get a subpoena for a case and you read the crime report and you go, I remember this, but 3 years?
Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
I hope they don't ask me too many super detailed questions because, you know, you can only remember so much.
Yeah. My longest one I ever got was 5 years. And it was a lead I did while on TDY. So I only had the lead sheet and the person to talk to, the little bit of background. So I just chatted this dude up for about 3 hours and got everything I could, wrote it all down. And I'm like, well, that's never going to see the light of day. And then, of course, because it was a lead. There wasn't even much of a case there. And somebody's still dragging that thing around 5 years later and just walk them through my notes. That's.
We were pretty much murders. They didn't want us to interview the suspects because if the guy says no, then
you're done.
You're done. And yeah. So are the detectives. And that's true anywhere, but you know, I've interviewed serial rapists, I've interviewed child molesters, I have interviewed on a limited scale murder suspects, but that was more about they wanted to talk and you know, so you stop them, read them their rights and stuff, and because they won't shut up and they're giving you good stuff, so you might as well get it in where you can use it.
Yep. Yeah, because if you didn't, if you played it cool and was like, hey man, just wait and talk to the detectives and they get smart, then you're getting blamed for that too.
Yeah, they get into jail and they instantly get a master's degree in lawyer land and all get that.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So, you had to play it by ear.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I've had this conversation on this before, but I have to have a map. I've got to have a map to start my process. When you can just throw it out there, like, all right, somebody runs bank robbery, you know, let's go chase them, and it leads to organized crime ring or something, and you can take that nugget and you can just take off and go, right?
Yeah,
that's kind of what. Wow, yeah. Yep, that's
you start up with this one little inspiration. I had one at the Public Safety Writers Conference last year in Las Vegas. I was sitting there, and it had nothing to do with what the speaker was. I felt guilty, but I'm kind of a multitasker. I can listen, and this thing just popped into my head, and I said, holy cow, that's a great opening. And it was just something as simple as a car pulling on a bridge and a fisherman down below, and somebody dumps something into the river and it pisses off the fisherman because he's like, hey, you're scaring my fish off here. And all of a sudden somebody starts shooting at him. And from there, the story grows.
Yeah. Something as simple as that.
You can take that and run with it. A lot of times when I'm writing, sometimes it's hard to conceptualize a thought, a plot scene, and how many chapters is that going to be? And so I've had several times where I finished a book and just ended up rolling it into the bank of future possible crimes.
Yeah. 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 I've got that file of this would make a really cool scene, but it doesn't fit here.
Yeah. Or I just ran out of space. You know, when I get over 90,000 words, I start looking for a way to shut it down.
Yeah. You can see, you can hear the editor getting mad.
Yeah. Yeah. I hope she gets paid by the word and not by the book.
Yeah. Right.
I've almost got on overages between the first three books. I've almost got two thirds of another book, but that's just the way the book went together in my head. And that's the way, you know, I like giving good value to the reader.
Yeah.
They're paying for it. And, you know, if I give them an extra 10,000 words or something like that, that's on me. But I'm doing it because I want them to walk away happy. It's like when you go buy a book in the bookstore and you pick it up and it's got good heft to it. And you feel like, okay, that was worth the $30, I guess, you know, nowadays.
Yeah. Nowadays.
That's for the cheap ones.
Yeah. It's oh man, there I go again. But it's funny you mentioned sitting in a lecture and just having an idea pop in your head. That happened to me at a book signing this weekend. And it's like, what, there's no worse time for that to happen. You're talking books with people, you know, having four conversations at once, and it's just right there spinning in my head. Just, oh man, here comes some like sneaking moments to sketch stuff. I just lay my notebook down on the chair. And as soon as somebody walks away, I just get a couple lines in and just keep sketching. Oh, it's really inconvenient.
I did that. It's actually in the second book, which is the title for the second book's Gasping for Air. And that's out and available now.
Yep.
I was driving to another town. I don't remember what the errand was. And all of a sudden, something popped in my brain. And I said, it was kind of built off of I read a lot of true crime serial killer stuff. And I'd read a story in this book. It was really interesting. It was about a serial killer that wasn't. And he'd harbored these feelings all these years, and he a little girl showed up on his front porch selling Girl Scout cookies or whatever. And now the Girl Scout cookies are becoming after me. But he just couldn't stop himself. And so I took that and kind of twisted it around and turned it around and made it different, but it was all from that little kernel of a crime. And it was in one of the many serial killer books I've read, but it was an example of a guy that they caught him after the first crime. And you think about that, and you know, the FBI has kind of changed their definition of what a serial killer is. Now, I don't know if they've changed it back, but when I was doing my research, it was three. Two wasn't enough. You had to kill three, and there had to be, you know, a different time period. So it couldn't be a spree killing. It had to be, you know, build up killing, and then a third one. And this guy had killed one. But if he'd gotten away with it, who knows how many people he would have killed if law enforcement hadn't intervened and they hadn't caught this guy.
Yeah. And I think they account for the compulsion aspect of it a lot more now than they used to, because it was a matter of looking at it in a very Newtonian mechanical way, three homicides serial. But as they learned through VICAP and all that stuff, I think they account for that behavioral aspect of, like you said, that build and build and build and the pressure and all that. It's, Yeah.
So they had to find a way to make a distinction between these mass shootings and a serial killer, because, you know, if you don't add that in, then any of these people that had gone into the malls and shot a bunch and killed a bunch of people, they could be considered serial killers.
Yep.
And it's a fascinating, just understanding the terminology and how they come up with these different labels is fascinating in itself. It's I enjoy the research I read, but then I sometimes come across an especially sick killer, and I have a hard time reading those.
Yeah, I like to make sure I surf that line of, you know, not supporting something that's exploitive of either the victim or celebritizing some monster. You know, that's you know, the majority of true crime, they really walk that line, and it's very easy to go one way or the other and get into that. Those lunatics, yeah, that like murder memorabilia and crazy stuff like that. It's like, that's, yeah, don't give a name to those people.
There's, and trust me, somebody's come up with a label for all of them, but there are there's a whole bunch of different varieties of very sick people out there running around in society that, you know, if we had a way to identify them a little better, shouldn't be.
Yep. Yeah, there's if there was only a filter process to, you know, get, think about that. I mean, how would you even start? Because that kind of monitoring, you know, it's funny every time, you know, and anybody go just throw a dart at a wall and pick a crime documentary that follows a serial killer, and they did it, got caught, got out, and then went on a rampage. So it's, sure, these guys they never are just pure. They get the system gets them, if the system fails, and they get let out.
Yeah. For the most part, these guys are, they start off doing one thing and they build up to it.
Yep.
And yep, that's kind of what I do with the primary antagonist in the first book, is he starts out in one specific type of crime. And if you actually read that carefully enough, you'll kind of read into he's actually started even before that.
Yep.
When he takes his little segue to his youth as a paper boy.
Yep. Yeah. And that's, and like I said, I like the way he was written. And I'll tell you, and I don't want to give any spoilers, but when he leaves, I'm like, how are we going to handle this, fellas? I'm like, our bad guy just went across the country. What's going on here? Yeah. But as you're writing him, you're showing those levels of compulsion, his, the narcissism, all that depth that really goes into that developing that kind of monster. But there are several times in this book where decisions, you make decisions, and I'm like reading them, like, I don't know how this is going to work out. And then I'm like, oh, this worked out marvelously, you know.
But JW is not always right. JW, yeah, our protagonist, is, you know, he's got his own hubris, and that reaches up as it's a plot point in a number of the books where JW makes an assumption based on what he's read or what he's seen, and it's wrong, and he almost gets himself or somebody else injured. So, if nothing else, the books are a study in the fallibility of man.
Yep. And it's honest. And it's honest. You know, the media can't believe it when we make a mistake, but, you know, they don't look at how many doctors are fired every year, how many teachers are fired every year, how many bankers go bad every year. But if we step the wrong way just a little bit, we're monsters.
Yep. Yeah. Well, and they don't really, police officers are not really afforded the opportunity to defend themselves very well. The media is not that interested in it, in my opinion. And their agencies most of the time are handcuffed anyway. The closest most of them get to defending themselves is the president of the police union goes out and says, this isn't right, and for these reasons.
Yeah.
Because the agencies can't, they know they're going to get sued. It's just part of the job.
Yeah, everybody loves the fireman, but it's really hard to like the guy writing you a ticket is what it always comes down to. Yeah,
policemen say no.
Yeah, policemen People say don't no. Like That's to right.
Be told no.
Yep.
Very seldom do a lot of the professions, but parking control is probably the worst because they go out and write somebody a ticket, and they get talked to in ways that you and I have never experienced.
Yep.
And I number of times over the years I was dispatched to assist parking control with an irate citizen. They were just asking for somebody to stand there while they could do their job.
Yep. And then more often than not, policy says that after that person gets done laying waste to your character, you have to give them your card and say, if you'd like to make a complaint, here's how you do it. Yep.
Yeah. I've had that happen before.
Oh, yeah.
That's part of the job.
Yep. You just have to know.
People are not going to be happy. And if the first thing you end up doing is you drive back to the station and you sit down at a computer and you file an info only memo outlining everything you did and why. So that you established in writing, because no crime occurred.
Yep.
But you have to cover yourself too.
Yeah. Every time. Yeah. So, but speaking of that, I mean, we've been going almost an hour, and everybody who comes on, whether they're, but you got both, you're a veteran and first responder. So, I ask everybody that comes in, where you are now, 20-year-old kid just gets out of college, is looking at, wants to be a cop. What's your advice?
I would tell them to pay attention to TV because it's not the easiest job right now, but I'll bounce it back to you. Your first few months on the job, after you've graduated, now you're out in patrol. I'm assuming that's where you went to first.
Oh yeah.
Some agencies you go to the jail for, sheriff's departments and such.
I wouldn't have made it.
All the old timers would grab you and say, kid, I don't know how you can do it. It sure isn't the same as when I started.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
And they're right. It's different and it changes and the job morphs. And, I went through, the Rodney King riots 1 and 2 and some other bad times in law enforcement when you were very unpopular in the community and you just got to ride it. It's a great profession. I had some really bad days. And we can talk about that the next time we chat.
Absolutely.
I wouldn't trade what I did and what I went through for anything because I worked with great people and I worked in a great city where for the most part, they supported you and they would listen when you would explain what you did and why you did it. But, this is a bad time, but that doesn't mean tomorrow can't be better. And, I guess I'm the eternal optimist in that regard, but I would not try to dissuade somebody from being a police officer,
no.
But I would also want them to go into it with their eyes open.
Yep. Yeah. And toss it back to me that the learning that we are the ones that say no was probably the one that I did not expect when you come out of the academy, they tell you you're a superhero now. And then you get on the street and your sergeant's like, you are nowhere near, like you are not the baddest person in the room. You never will be. So
nope, there's always somebody bigger and badder.
Yeah. Be humble. And,
that was the hardest part for me, I think, was the humility aspect. I had come out of the Marine Corps and went into the police academy and came out of the academy number one. And I was, I didn't have any illusions of lighting the world on fire. But in the same breath, it just that hubris got you. Because you didn't think you could do wrong. You didn't think you were doing wrong when you did things. But sometimes you were wrong. But it takes experience to get it right. That's why, working in one, I'm a big fan of two officer cars.
Yep.
Because you pair up a a youngster with somebody with some seniority and somebody with some maturity, and that's been around the block a few times and has dealt with a lot of different situations and seen the good and the bad. And they have that opportunity to learn in that environment and try things that don't work. Whereas if you're by yourself, bad things can happen to you.
Before you even know it, bad things can be happening to you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yep. I used to teach on officers killed in the line of duty. And it was from the FBI study on that. And, you know, they interviewed killers of police officers in prison that basically all their appeals were done. They had really nothing to gain by lying, but they also knew enough about what they were doing. And it was interesting, in only, there was 40 some killings in that year that they studied. Only one case had the suspect started out the night with the intention of killing an officer. Every other one, it was something that happened during that contact that led the suspect to make the decision, I can kill this guy and get away with it.
Yep.
That one really kind of left a mark on me, because it wasn't necessarily what was in the suspect's mind. It was the situation, not saying it was the officer's fault, but the officer allowed the suspect to believe he could do it. Well, you can't do that. You have to be in control all the time.
And all the different variables that go into whatever made that mind click, thinking he had that split second. Because, I mean, action versus reaction, we're always the last ones to know we're about to get punched, you know?
Yeah.
So
don't show me a cop show where the suspect draws the gun and the cop outdraws him. And you've got a significant lag there, just sensing the threat and making up your mind what you're going to do. I used to do that in class. We'd take training pistols that were made so they couldn't fire, and I'd hand it to a young police recruit, and I'd set mine on the table, and tell him, cover me. You got me? Because I'm going to pick that up and I'm going to shoot you with it. And I could generally get it up, and the best they would get would be a tie.
A tie, yeah.
Yeah. And I asked him, I said, how do you feel about a tie? You know, you've got a hole in your body now and you're bleeding, maybe to death. How do you feel about that? They said, you know, that's what cover's for. That's what tactics are for. That's what backup is for. All those things, they're there for a reason. And you they're all tools that we give you, and you got to use them.
Yeah. Yeah. And they've done good with the stress inoculation. That's really become a big part of training, but still not the same when somebody goes, you know, makes that move that first time. It's just not. It's
just you can't sense it and react fast. They've already made up their mind.
Yep. Yep. They're way ahead of you.
Yeah. Yeah. They can draw and shoot usually before you, unless they fumble picking it up or drawing. Yep.
But yeah, it's so many variables into it. Nope. But no, I think you're absolutely right. I would never, I think it's one of the, if not the best profession, it's gotta be way up there. But just for the experience alone, and like you said, the humility and understanding community and the way people work, I don't know what else is quite comparable to that patrol.
I never came up with anything, you know, and then you get in within law enforcement, what was your best job? What was the one thing you had that you liked the most?
Yep. I think, canine. The one I go back to, and I know there's a bunch of dudes, friends of mine that will scoff, but, when I think back over it all now, it was when I was running, you know, single car patrol, on the beat. Cause the thing I loved about it was you have no idea what's going to happen when you leave roll call. And it's crazy. It can be a dead night, or you can be wondering what just happened when you go home.
Yeah. Yeah. I liked the dog just because you were always in the middle of things.
Yeah. Yep.
Instead of standing around on the outside looking in, of course, that can come back and bite you. I had a dog shot on a SWAT call. You know, we'll talk about that some other time. We don't have enough time to talk about that.
Yeah.
But that dog is actually in the books.
Is that Asco or Axo?
Asco.
Yeah, Asco? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a real dog, real police dog.
Wow.
I've just explored the tip of that, because working with a patrol dog versus this scent detection dog is a completely different world. And it's so, you know, if you've got a good dog, you ask any dog handler, you know, you spend so much time working with the dog, and you know, when they get a find, and you know, whether it's drugs or a hiding suspect or whatever, it's just there's a rush there that's just not matched by any.
And I don't have a whole lot of experience with the dogs, but when you are out there and they hit, the rush coming from the dog, like that adrenaline and how happy they are and the job they did, it's infectious. Cause you're standing out there, we're a bunch of professional police officers, you know, I'll dude it up looking good in our uniforms. And here's the canine guy and the dog dancing around in the street. Throwing a tennis ball, and we're all just like, oh, well, that is one way to celebrate a touchdown. Like that's, you know,
that's a second Christmas
yeah.
for both of you, dog and him.
Yeah.
It's because you do so much and there's an incredible amount of pressure on both the dog and the handler when they're searching. Is the last thing you want is to miss a suspect or miss some dope or whatever. But it happens. It does happen. And you know, fortunately, usually doesn't end up with somebody getting hurt, but I've seen it happen. And a lot of times it's kind of like with the scent work. When you miss a suspect, you don't know. You don't know what went wrong. You don't know, you know, why the dog didn't get it. And I allude to this in the books about, sometimes the dog does his job and you misread it or you ignore it.
Yep.
It happens.
Or you mentioned also the fatigue. Yeah. You know, is the handler fatigued? Is the dog fatigued? And sure. The dog's looking to you for advice because he feels like you should go left and you just keep pulling him right.
Well, he wants to make you happy. So you got to be careful not to coax him into an alert.
Yeah.
Make him work, make him do his job. But, you know, he's looking at you like, well, first of all, he wants his reward, toy, whatever, but he also wants you to be happy with him. And so you have to train for that. You have to train for the no finds.
Yeah.
You know, where there's nothing there. And then you got to praise the dog up for doing a good job. And that confuses
him. Yeah. I always did like the, when they'd find something and that, you know, that just a silly, that chew toy, that the most ridiculous, like, stuffed animal chew toy, you're tossing this to this cop. here's your reward. And the cops, that, you know, this four-legged cop shaking a teddy bear around the street or something. Yeah. that never got old. I don't want to keep it too much, but we definitely have to do this again because I feel like we could probably go on forever. So
I got lots of stories. We just barely scratched the surface.
Oh yeah, we'll call this part one, everybody. So we'll definitely do this again. But are you on socials or?
I'm on Facebook. I'm on Facebook personally, but if you're following my page, you're going to see a lot of pictures of my grandchildren. But I have a Big Dogs author page where I'll be posting. You know, when do you believe this will come out?
It'll be 2 weeks. Today is probably 3 to 4 weeks. I got a couple stacked up in front of you.
Okay.
But I'll definitely
I will warn, you know, give out a warning alert that it's coming. And then, let me know just before it does and I'll send out a reminder. But I do a lot of that. And then occasionally I throw in a tidbit about the books or something because, you know, it makes it more fun.
Awesome.
For everybody, you know, and that's to me, that's the only reason to do the Facebook page. I, I want to make it more interesting for the readers, maybe give them a little bit of insight into the how and the why. Why did I do that? Which is one of the fun things about having multiple books down now, because some of it makes sense.
Yep. Yeah. And it sounds like you could host trivia night too. But I'll get in that. I'll find them all in part two. I guarantee.
Yeah. Give you some time. That'll give you some time to read the second book, and you know, we can talk about that one a little bit. You'll like in that regard. The second book really starts to JW builds his team and starts picking, because he knows he can't do this by himself. And so the second book really, there's a lot of things going on in it to continue the story, but a lot of what it's about is JW building a team, understanding that he can't stay physically where he is. He needs more room, because he can't do it with just these two dogs.
Yeah.
He's going to need more dogs. He's going to need and people to support all that.
Yeah. That's going to be cool. I'm looking forward to it. I can't wait.
I'll make sure they send you one.
Yeah. I appreciate it. Absolutely. Steve, I appreciate you coming in, and everything's on Amazon, any place you buy books, Wild Blue's website. Wild Blue has some pretty good articles that Steve wrote based on big dogs. So you should probably check those out too. We will talk to you guys later.